It was in such a competition that Sita Devi accepted Lord Ramachandra as her husband, and that Draupadi accepted Arjuna in other instances. So marriage by agreement or by selecting one's own husband in an open competition is allowed. There are eight kinds of marriage, of which marriage by agreement is called Gandharva marriage. Generally, the parents select the husband or wife for their daughter or son, but Gandharva marriage takes place by personal selection. Still, although marriage by personal selection or by agreement took place in the past, we find no such thing as divorce by disagreement. Of course, divorce by disagreement took place among low-class men, but marriage by agreement was found even in the very highest classes, especially in the royal Kshatriya families. Maharaj Dushmanta's acceptance of Sukuntala as his wife was sanctioned by Vedic culture. How the marriage took place is described in the next verse. Om Agyana Timurandasha Gananjala Shalakaya Chakshur Unmilitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. So yesterday in the class, Dravida Prabhu gave us some orientation of why we're here and what we're hearing in this story of the marriage of King Dushmanta and Shakuntala. And we could be here for many different reasons, particularly because this Dushmanta-Shakuntala union is one that's very culturally popular and known in India. There are a number of different marriages that people know of in the Vedic history, or say even modern Hindu society. Dushmanta Shakuntala is one. There's Savitri Satyavan, Nal Damayanti. These are stories that even Prabhupada related. And so we could be here for a number of reasons, as I say, based on the cultural aspect or the Hinduism aspect of this union. But of course, as Dravida Prabhu was explaining, we're here primarily because this is leading to the birth of Lord Krishna and his appearance. He gave us a wonderful verse of Krishna's face yesterday. So that's why we're here in the Bhagavatam discussing this. Now, in the purport, it's also interesting in various ways because on one sense, this purport can be described in the negative in the sense that what it's not. This is not in the purport, from one perspective at least, it's not Prabhupada giving us Siddhanta or philosophical conclusions about the absolute truth of our relationship with Lord Sri Krishna. Neither is it lila or description of Krishna's transcendental pastimes. It's not Siddhanta, not lila. It's also not Prabhupada encouraging us in the Sankirtan movement of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to go and spread Krishna consciousness. It's not those things. In one sense, it's not those things. What it is it's almost like a cultural explanation of Aryan civilization or the Vedic culture. We're getting the history of this marriage, which is famous for being a particular type, one of the eight types of marriage that are described in the Mahabharata and in Vedic civilization. Just some general advice about how it's good to act. So in one sense, if we look at it in those terms, we We couldn't miss the Krishna conscious conclusion that we know that Srila Prabhupada gives whenever he speaks. Srila Prabhupada spoke on so many different subjects, but he always brought it to a conclusion. He didn't just leave us hanging out there with different stories or tales or wise sayings from the Vedic culture, but he brought it to a conclusion. And sometimes that conclusion was a little difficult to discern. I remember once when we were traveling as brahmacharis, we were at the Fisher Mansion in Detroit. And we were parked in our motorhome outside the mansion, and we were taking rest. It was probably 9 or 10 o'clock at night, and all of a sudden there came a knock on the window. And the Prabhupada's secretary said, "Satsvarup, Prabhupada wants to see you." Because Prabhupada was visiting Detroit at that time. So we were all very excited. Of course, we didn't all get the call. Satsvarup Maharaj got the call, so he got up and he went to go see Srila Prabhupada. And of course, we couldn't sleep. You know, we're laying there waiting. He's waiting, and he comes back. What he's going to say? What did Prabhupada say? And so, I don't know, an hour, maybe 2 hours went by. We're waiting anxiously for Satsvarup Maharaj to come back. And when he finally comes back, we all pounce upon him. What did Prabhupada say? What did he want to see you about? And he said that, well, Prabhupada was talking about the British in India. He spent the whole time just talking about the British in India. You know, how they did this, how they did that, and how they messed up India, and how they cut off the thumbs of the, you know, the weavers and all these kind of things. And then, you know, that was it. You know, he just talked about it. So, Prabhupada talked on so many subjects. But he did bring those subjects to a conclusion, and we find a conclusion here as well in Prabhupada's relation of this history of Dushmanta and Sukuntala. And he brings it down to this point of that there was no divorce by disagreement. There was no divorce by disagreement. Now, of course, even divorce, there are many social ills that come from divorce. And you know, we could dwell on them, and you know, sometimes we do dwell on them for good reasons. But what is Prabhupada's reason for bringing this discussion down to this statement that still, although marriage by personal selection or agreement took place in the past, we found no such thing as divorce by disagreement? Well, I'd like to just put forward my own understanding of this, and I'm sure others have deeper understandings of it. But one reason why Prabhupada brings it down to that conclusion is because in this entire section of the Bhagavatam, we've been hearing about relationships between men and women and attempts for people to find happiness or satisfaction in those relationships. And divorce, in one sense, is an attempt to change one's situation in life so that he can find more happiness. And that's one way that we can look at reasons why people take to divorce by disagreement, as Prabhupada is describing here. In an attempt to find a better situation, more happiness, whatever, in life. And as I said, although many social evils can come from divorce, that's not the focus that I'm making here. The focus I'm making here is that it's an illusory attempt in this material world to try to change our circumstances to find happiness. And if we think that we can do that through divorce or whatever way there is, then that's the mistake we're making. And that's the lesson we need to learn in our Krishna consciousness. That the material world is set up in such a way that we can't find happiness simply by changing the elements that we find ourselves dealing with in life. There's no adjustments that we can make to this material nature that's going to ultimately make us happy. And therefore, even if there's disagreement in marriage, one should not be under the illusion that by divorce that happiness can be found. I think that's an important lesson to learn from Prabhupada's purport here. How not to be influenced by that type of illusion. Indeed, other instruction that we find in the Vedic culture gives us information, not just the negative here of divorce, but other information about how to lead one's life, sort of culturally lead one's life for one's best interest in Krishna consciousness. For instance, when Maharaj Yudhisthira was responding to the yaksha at the lake where his brothers all died, you remember the conversation? I think Dravida mentioned it yesterday also about the most wonderful thing. So that question was asked about what's the most wonderful thing, and Maharaj Yudhisthira replied correctly that the most wonderful thing is that people are seeing death all around them, but they think they won't die. But there was another question. There were many other questions asked in that exchange, and one of the questions was, what are the three things that one should always be satisfied with? Does anybody know what the three things one should always be satisfied with are? Vasasuna? With the wife? With the wealth, the money? The third one, anybody know? With the food that one gets. One should always be satisfied. If one's going to be happy in life, you need to start here. Be satisfied with your wife, with the wealth you earn. It comes naturally of its own accord, and with the food you eat. These are basic elements of being happy in life, and being happy and content in life gives you the opportunity to pursue Krishna consciousness. If you are always running after these three things, these are pretty big aspects of everyone's life. Food. Think how much time we spend just putting food on the table. Think how much time the temple takes preparing prasad for us if we don't put the food, our own food, on the table. Putting the food on the table, earning money, and in married life, most people get married. I mean, renunciation is obviously prominent in our shastras. I was just hearing this morning about Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, our great acharya, a previous acharya. He was married, but he went to Vrindavan. He left his wife, went to Vrindavan, and then his guru called him back to Bengal. And when he called him back, he said, well, you know, you're married. You're not spending any time with your wife. You know, I order you, spend the night with your wife. So he went and he spent the night with his wife, but the whole time he was just giving Srimad Bhagavatam class. So he was, you know, reciting the Bhagavatam, and bhajans and everything. At the end of the night, you know, the report came to the guru. He said, what can I do? You know, you're just a renounced soul. So renunciation is there, but most people get married. Most people get married, and most people have these problems: food, money, marriage. And so how to be satisfied in those things is important if we are to pursue Krishna consciousness. If we're not peaceful in those situations, then Krishna consciousness becomes just that much more difficult. So we're advised to be satisfied in that way. Particularly with marriage. Now, marriage is also one of the, and this may help us to be satisfied in that regard, marriage is one of the major things that in our lives that come to us by our previous karma. Any astrologer, if they're going to have a business in astrology, they need to know the marriage get the marriage thing down, you know, because that's what everyone's going to come and ask. When am I getting married? Who am I going to marry? So every parent's asking, how am I going to get my kids married? You know, who's going to, you know, everyone's going to the astrologer for that reason only. So marriage is one of the major things that come to us by our previous karma. And so therefore we can't complain. What's to complain? You know, we desired in a way, we acted in a way, and we're getting the results of those actions in terms of husband and wife. And so we shouldn't complain about the situation or falsely think that we can try to change it by adjusting the material arrangements. So this verse describes in the purport here eight types of marriages that are in the Vedic tradition. So my next quiz is, Vyasasuna only got 2 out of 3, but here are 8, and we have from the purport one type of marriage that's given to us, but who can tell me the 8 types of marriage that are in the Vedic tradition? Can anyone say? I knew Chivikram was going to know these things, you know.
They have one with the fourth one, I think, is Brahma or Brahmitya, something like that, where the father gives...
Okay, just name them. I'm going to describe them. So you got number one, Brahma marriage, yes. Indrapatya.
Then you have like Raksha.
Rakshasha.
Yeah, of course you have Gandharva.
Gandharva.
You have Rakshasa.
Swayamvara is not one of them. That's a ceremony.
Well, anyhow.
Okay, that's good. You did good, Prabhu. You got like some of them. Let me describe them here.
I can explain them, but I can't.
Yeah, let me describe them here. And these go from sort of the highest type or the best type to the lowest type. But it's interesting that they, although they're like that, as I described, you'll see, and we'll go through some examples, of very great devotees, even the Lord himself, engaging in marriages which are way down on the list. So, again, these different types of marriages, always, although we say one's higher than another, it doesn't always mean that, you know, oh, there's going to be more happiness, or this has a happy ending, that one doesn't have a happy ending, or whatever. They're just different types. So there's Brahma marriage. And in this marriage, a man of good qualities and good family is asked to come and receive the damsel. And it says this type of marriage will give the man prosperity. This is the kind of marriage that I guess any parent, father of a daughter would want, you know, that essentially they have a daughter and a good qualified young man comes and asks for the hand of the daughter. And the daughter is given in marriage in that way. That's Brahma. Then there's Arsha, which is a marriage that takes place after getting a couple of cows from the bridegroom. The bridegroom comes and he gives a couple of cows, and then the bride is given to him in return. There's an example of this type of marriage that we're familiar with, and that's Sukanya and Chaivana Muni, at least in one Hindu website, and this is like Hinduism 101 today. One Hindu website, they do say that the third form, Arsha, suggests that it is concerned with the rishis and sages. It seems the marriage of Sukanya to Chaivana was this type. You remember Chaivana and Kanya? He was the old man, Chaivana Muni, old man, and he got a very young daughter. And so she was given to him by her father. Apparently there was some exchange of cows involved in that. Arsha. So the third type is Prajapatya. And this is where a virgin girl is given to the man who had requested her hand as a duty. And some of these are a little confusing to me, and so if any of you know any of this, you might want to share with us. But this Prajapatya marriage, I was trying to think of an example of this, and what example did I have? Oh, because they talk about the duty involved here. The daughter is given in marriage almost out of duty, and it made me think of the two Brahmins, the old Brahmin and a young Brahmin who went on tour of India, and then before Sakshi Gopal, a promise was made that I will give you my daughter in marriage. Then they came back and the family was against it, but eventually, not that the young Brahmin wanted the wife in some way, had some desire for the wife, but it was a matter of duty to the deity. You promised before the deity, you can't neglect that duty. And so as a matter of duty, you must give your daughter to me. And so I thought that may be an example of this type of marriage where duty is involved. Okay, so number four, Daiva. The virgin is offered to the master who is engaged in performing a sacrifice. And so performance of sacrifice. At sacrifices, we know that there are different things are given in charity. And so a marriage taking place in that situation, apparently. And again, I don't claim to have complete knowledge of all these types of marriages. But apparently a sacrifice is going on, and many things are given at the time of sacrifice. And so a wife is given as well. Okay, number five, Gandharva. And as I said, this apparently includes the Swayamvara that you were mentioning, Dravidar, because Gandharva, as described by Prabhupada here in the purport, involves the selection. Other definitions of this Gandharva marriage are love marriage. In India, you find they have a love marriage. It means it wasn't arranged by their parents. Somehow or another, it was a love marriage not arranged by their parents. So this is a mutual agreement between husband and wife, is this type of Gandharva. But also there's this Swayamvar where there's a competition and the wife picks the husband, selects the husband in that way. Apparently that's also this Gandharva type of a marriage. Then there's Asura marriage. And now we're getting into marriages which are a little dicey here. And the Asura, there's apparently an exchange of money, for, you know, like giving money in return for the damsel and marrying her. And in this definition that's in the Puranic Encyclopedia, it says that this type is mean. It's a mean, you know, it's a mean kind of thing where there's money given. And I have another reference here that describes that also as being not so nice. The Asura type. In the Asura type, the groom is in no way a match for the girl, but her father and her relatives receive a good deal of money from the man, who then forces them to let him marry her. That's the Asura type. It reminded me, I don't know if you know, right? You know, Fiddler on a Roof. I don't know. In Fiddler on a Roof, there is that kind of a situation where older guys, you know, giving money. So that's not such a nice type of marriage, Asura. Then there's Rakshasa. That's one that we're familiar with. And again, although it's Rakshasa type of marriage, who's the example of a Rakshasa type marriage? Huh? Krishna Rukmini. Krishna rides in, you know, and he just kidnaps her. And those Rakshasa marriages, apparently it's not always against the girl's wishes. And obviously it wasn't against Rukmini's wishes. And so it's not against the wishes of the girl that a marriage takes place like that. Yeah, there's a fight, you know, going, and there's some that type of kidnapping and things like that. Samba also. Also Bhishma. When Bhishma went to get the two brides for his brother, Vichitravirya, he also just took the girls. And this is a good example, this Bhishma example, because it shows how happiness always doesn't result. Because one of the, he got three of them, right? And but one of them, Amba, she didn't like it. You know, hey, what are you doing? I'm already wanted to get married to this other guy. And ultimately she didn't accept it, and she committed suicide, essentially. And then she came back because she wanted to kill Bhishma. So Arjuna and Subhadra is another one of that type of marriage. So again, it doesn't always result in a happily ever ending storybook type of marriage, these type of things. And so the last one here is Pishacha. And this is a marrying a damsel when she is sleeping or lying unconscious. So, but actually there's an example that I wanted to mention here, and I don't know if it's an example of this, but you can let me know. But you know that Usa and Aniruddha was sleeping, right? And Usa's girlfriend, Chitraleka, she brought him there in a sleeping condition. And when he woke up, essentially he was married. He was in the women's quarters. So I don't know if that's an example of that or not. Okay, that doesn't work? Okay. All right, well, that doesn't work. But that is a type of marriage, one of the eight types of marriages that are there. And so, again, I think the lesson is from all of this that no matter what type of marriage is undertaken, still it's one of the samskaras. It's one of the vows, sacred vows, that sort of lead our lives. And the samskaras take place even before the conception of a child, and that at each stage in the life. And again, marriage is one of the major samskaras. And they're meant to be purificatory activities. So if we're getting purified and we think that we can just change that by divorce or something like that, then not only are we going against sort of culturally what's helpful for us to lead our lives, but we're going against the opportunity that we have in this life to progress in our Krishna consciousness. And so I think that's why Prabhupada gives us this conclusion and lesson here from the purport when he speaks about that there was no divorce by disagreement. In the lower classes there were, but the lower classes have many challenges to become Krishna conscious, and indeed that's why we consider them lower classes, not necessarily that they have less money or they live in a particular neighborhood or something, but because they're subject to so many distractions which prevent them from moving forward with their real business in life, which is Krishna consciousness. So divorce in those circumstances is just another distraction from the path. But in higher classes, these distractions aren't there or not meant to be there, and so they shouldn't be introduced by trying to become happy by undertaking them. So are there any comments or questions about this subject matter? Madan Mohan, Prabhu.
Thank you for such a nice class. I was had a question on balancing. We have an overriding principle: accept those things favorable for your Krishna consciousness. And we know pretty much now what is favorable, what's unfavorable. So if you make the decision based on trying to find happiness, we see that that's that's a material principle. But if it's a spiritual principle, so for devotees, we kind of like have an extra overriding element that has to be balanced in there, that not for happiness, but for Krishna consciousness. And there's some instructions on that. I was wondering if you could explain a little.
Right. Well, Prabhupada got people married to help them in their Krishna consciousness. So, yeah, we get married to help our Krishna consciousness. And so everything that our lives are arranged to help promote our Krishna consciousness.
I was thinking
divorce?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know that divorce will help your Krishna consciousness. Separation may help your Krishna consciousness, and that there's no prescription against that separation. And so, separation comes naturally anyway with the advancement of age. But if there's some necessity before that, then in a responsible way, separation may be there. But I think it also doesn't help your Krishna consciousness if you're sort of irresponsibly socially, because then that means we want to be servant. And if we're placing what should be our burden at someone else's doorstep and say, you take care of this, then that's not going to be helpful for our Krishna consciousness. So anything can be used in Krishna consciousness, and ultimately Krishna consciousness doesn't really depend on all of these things. It's independent of these things. Still, we need to be careful in dealing with the material energy, and so there are different facilities that are given. Dravidapu.
You mentioned three things that we're meant to be satisfied with, and this line came to mind that I remember from the Gita, yadrichcha labha santushto, which means exactly that, be satisfied with what comes easily of its own accord. And then you said that if one is satisfied with those things, what you eat, with your wealth and your wife or husband, then you can proceed, practice Krishna consciousness more easily. But isn't it true that it's your Krishna consciousness that enables you to be satisfied with those things? Especially in a culture like ours where there are so many opportunities for being dissatisfied with that. The whole culture is trying to make you dissatisfied, so you'll buy this, do this, and going like that. Mm-hmm. So it seems like there's kind of a synergy there. In other words, yes, it's good to be satisfied and you can have peaceful mind in practice, but by practicing Krishna consciousness, you can also be satisfied with those things.
Right, yeah, I think you're right. There is a synergy, both, but it goes both ways. Yes, yes.
Hare Krishna. So, as I remember, there is three types that you have to be satisfied, and also there's three things that you shouldn't be satisfied.
Okay.
These three is tapa, dana, and japa. Mm-hmm. So whatever austerity you perform, you shouldn't be satisfied, it's enough. And that charity that you give, you shouldn't be satisfied. And japa, what you're chanting, is you shouldn't be satisfied with the quality of your japa and with the number.
Yeah, that's very good, very good. Two things. Actually, I was thinking about you when I was hearing the story of Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, because you gave the class the other day about the Brahmin who was simply studying, and then the candle blew out at night, and then when he lit the candle, he was surprised. Who are you? Because he didn't recognize his wife, because he was studying so much. I was thinking about that story when I was hearing about Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. I was wondering if that's a story about him, that he was like that. But yes, we shouldn't be satisfied with those three things. Japa, dana, tapa. Okay. Yes.
So all those types of marriage you described, they're all involving a virgin girl.
Well, the virgin girl is mentioned in relation to some of them. I would assume that in the Brahma marriage, the virgin girl is involved. I would assume so. I would assume that they're all there. Although I have to do more research, I just have the Puranic Encyclopedia reference, and they mention virgin girl in only two of them. But I imagine that doesn't include Brahma, which is the top, highest, so-called highest one. I would imagine that that's applicable there too. Well, I mean, it's, yeah?
That was the problem with
Amma. Give him the mic.
The problem with Amba was not that she wasn't a virgin, but she had spent the night away from her father's home, and therefore no one would accept her. So in high-class society, the woman had to be untouched by any other man. That's why they married them young.
Yeah, that's why Krishna married the 16,100 wives also, because they were outside the home and captured by another. So I think probably, yeah, that's there. But I don't know if we over-idealize Vedic culture to think that there were no women that weren't virgins that weren't married. Obviously that situation probably existed. How it was dealt with, I don't know. Yeah.
There's nothing like an unmarried girl that's not a virgin in Vedic culture. This case with Amber really is because she was infatuated with Salya, but it's not like they spend the night or cohabit or anything like that, and that was why she was actually rejected, you know. But within Vedic culture, it's only virgin girls are accepted in marriage. You know, if one is not, then that's not accepted in Vedic culture. My point was, the reason Srila Prabhupada emphasized this too is because divorce is easily accessible in the West, and it's very prevalent, see? Very easily accessible and very prevalent, really. And I guess, you know, Srila Prabhupada from time to time would hit out like this. So, you know, to make us more aware, really, you know. If there's some trivial, there's some quarrel, you know, this and that, one has to learn to tolerate these things, you know, and continue in life.
Yes?
That women who has been married, that they are allowed to be married again. I think, I'm not clearly recalling, but there are situations where the husband dies or there are different things, as far as I remember mentioning. It's mentioned there in Manusamhita that the woman is allowed to remarry.
Yeah, as I said, I imagine we don't want to over-idealize Vedic civilization and think that there aren't situations that, like that. So, it's 9:45. We'll end there. Gantarashi Madhbhagavatam.